Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. A newly released study shows self-censorship in Fiji's media remains a problem, despite the return to democratic rule in 2014. Veteran Fiji journalist Ricardo Morris's research, conducted from December 2015 to December 2016, was sponsored by the Thomson Reuters Foundation, and his analysis has just been made published. Mr. Morris told Sally Round that the study wasn't easy to undertake because self-censorship is still a prickly subject in Fiji.
The main mechanism of the survey was an online survey of quite a number of questions. And within those set of questions were eight questions which targeted at measuring self-censorship. And this was done using a survey developed about 10 years ago. It was developed by researchers who study public opinion research. So I used that tool as a mechanism to measure how willing or not journalists were to self-censor. And the rest of the questionnaire was questions relating to media freedom and the perception of journalists of what their role is in the Fiji's media industry.
And you got 40 respondents willing to answer the survey, and you sent out 100 links to the survey. Were you surprised that less than half of those came forward?
No, not surprising at all. I mean, I actually expected much less than 40. I was able to get a good range of respondents from across the mainstream media and also some of the smaller media organizations.
So what did you actually find? What were the conclusions?
In brief, the survey showed that journalists in Fiji, while they generally stuck to neutrality, they chose the middle ground, safe space of the middle ground. There was a slight leaning towards self-censorship. However, when the follow-up interviews were conducted with some of those respondents, these were open-ended questions that were asked of these respondents. It painted a completely different picture in which they explained, sometimes in detail, about how self-censorship would work in their particular newsroom. And the questions about the role perception of Fiji's journalists, without fail, they mention factors such as fairness, balance, independence, fearlessness. But again, this perception and the practice appear to be disconnected.
And some of those anecdotes were interesting, weren't they? Some of the practices that those journalists said that they employed. Can you just tell us about some of them?
Some of the journalists I had spoken to talked about how they would get a call from the powers that be if they were not happy with a particular story. And then the journalist or the editor in charge would have to explain in writing to the news manager, who then had to explain to the CEO of a company, because these journalists then feared the consequences. They would then, the next day and later on, without being prompted, they would be much more careful, so to speak, about what they put on the news. So there's also some discussion about touching up a story. A few journalists didn't term it as self-censorship or didn't want to admit that it was self-censorship. They spoke about it as touching up a story or leaving out views that they felt may trigger a negative response. So those are some of the things that they disclosed in the follow-up interviews.
There was also a perception that you found among journalists that they had a role of supporting national development and social cohesiveness, that that was an important role for journalists. Can you just elaborate on that?
Because of the political environment that a lot of the journalists have grown up in over the past 10 years, and also because there's a growing understanding of the power of the media, of the power that can be sometimes misused, and then there's also an understanding because of the reforms that have taken place in Fiji politically, socially. We now realize in the media as well that the media must also play a part in national development, not just a watchdog role in which it stands on the sidelines and points out faults, but also a media that's now coming to understand that it, while also pointing out faults, it should also be part of the solution. So that is the kind of perception that this new generation of journalists, and also some who have come through from the previous generation, have come to accept and understand that this is what a media in this country ought to be now. I mean, I must say that it's probably because also that there has been media laws that has virtually imposed this on us. And while a majority of people agree that there should be some law reforms to the media laws, there's an understanding that in the meantime, nothing much can be done. We just need to get on with it. And accepting that the media has a development role is one of those things.
That was veteran Fiji journalist Ricardo Mora speaking to Sally Round about a new study that he released on how self-censorship still plays in the media in Fiji. Well, let's talk now about photography. Photography, of course, is, well, everywhere. Every newspaper, magazine, exhibitions, and everything. But one important part of news coverage where photography has been very important in the past and still continues to be important today, because as they say, a picture tells a thousand words, is covering conflicts. Now, in the early days of photography, the sheer amount of heavy equipment and time required to take a picture, well, it was very difficult. And considering that if you were in a war situation, it was extremely difficult. Now, technology, of course, has changed. But there's still some difficulty in covering war through photographs. Anne Wilkes Tucker, she's the curator of photography at the Museum of Fine Arts at Austin, Texas, in the United States. She speaks next to Richard Ady about her book, War Photography, Images of Armored Conflict and Its Aftermath.
The photography has changed technically, of course, from when the photographers had to have a darkroom along with him to where they could have an image on air 7 seconds after they took it. The technology of armaments has changed, so the distance of the photographers has changed with that. But a large part of our project was devoted to the idea that there are certain inherent stages in armed conflict that photographers have photographed that don't change across time, across culture, across faith, across tribes, that there is a relationship between this entity called war and this entity called photography that has variation but also has pattern.
I will come back to that because I think it's the real truism that emerges from both what I've heard about the exhibition and certainly what is in the book that goes with it. But I am also interested in what's changed. So in the early days, and there's an image from the Second Opium War in China from 1860, photographers obviously couldn't capture movement then. The technology
Correct.
Just wasn't up to it. So it's all about the aftermath then, isn't it?
The early pictures, well, portrait is the most common picture taken during warfare because everybody wants to leave somebody with a portrait. And then trying to describe what's happening to others, photographers were left photographing the aftermath, whether it be dead on the battlefield or the destruction of property or the wounded or prisoners of war. All of these aspects that occur afterwards, because through the 19th century, a photographer needed a tripod, and somebody with a tripod might as well have a red flag saying to snipers, here I am, come shoot me. And, of course, the cameras and the films were not technically capable of recording action. So the Boer War is the first war with film camera, snapshot camera, and the submachine gun. So, and then, of course, World War One is things even advance even further.
And one of the effects of that, those early limitations, is that I think more photos were staged. But it's, I mean, has that ever gone away? Or do we still have,
no.
we still
no.
have that?
No, there's still controversy. I just served on the World Press Photo Jury, and we had a lot of discussions about what photographers are and are not allowed to do to still be news, to still be factual, because certain photographs are most desired by both the press and their audiences, it's just very tempting to come up with them even if you haven't. So there's a photograph in the exhibition of some men who look like they're charging the battlefield. They're actually charging the cookhouse. And there's a famous photograph which is supposed to be dueling a pilot from a biplane falling out of the plane that is in flames, and it's actually a toy plane. So you have to be careful. You have to consider, has the photographer totally faked or even substantially altered the picture? Has it crossed some line of factualness that is important?
Yeah, the other thing, and that gets us into something related, I think, is that photo I mentioned a moment ago by Felice Beato, one of the very first war photographers, and he allegedly called the scene beautiful. And that gets into an issue that must come up again and again. Is it reportage? Is it art?
Well, I'm not willing to make that dichotomy. I think that reportage can be an exquisitely beautiful photograph. And in fact, one of the great tensions of the exhibition, for instance, there's a Ken Jarecki photograph of an Iraqi soldier in the Gulf War who has been burned, completely burned, while in his truck when his truck was bombed. And there's a tension, there's a push-pull standing in front of the photograph because the tonalities, the everything that is aesthetic about the picture is pulling you in, and what you are looking at is pushing you away. And that's one of the complexities that are important to the power of the photograph.
One thing I'm really interested in is how you grouped the pictures. They're in themes. So there's, you know, beforehand, there's patrol and troop movements, there's the aftermath, there's civilians in grief, all those different categories, more besides. Why did you do it that way?
We worked 10 years on it. The first 3 or 4 years, we were the curators, the three curators, myself, Will Michaels, and Natalie Zelt. We traveled and we came to the Australian War Memorial and the National Gallery of Australia, and we interviewed photographers in Australia. We went to the Imperial War Museum in London. We went to museums and collections in Spain and all over the United States, France. And we'd look at images all day, and then at night we would talk about what images were still in our mind. Say we'd looked at 1,000 images in a day between us, and what images were still memorable. And then we began to make lists of those, and then we began to compare them, and we realized there were patterns and things that were reoccurring, such as a woman grieving at a graveside, and aftermath and medical issues. Then we, at this stage, we invited in military historians, and they said, look, the patterns that you're setting up are actually patterns that we in the military work with and engage in our plans and in our training, and that these are inherent stages for armed conflict. So it seemed to us that that was something that we hadn't previously seen discussed or recognized. And that's when we added the slash in the title, that the show is about war and its inherent nature and photography and its engagement with war. And it was only at the last stages that we realized that these patterns could be organized in the rough order of war, so that someone going through the book or going through the exhibition is seeing the evolution of engagement of the combatant through the eyes of photographers.
This is the Media Report, the Anzac Day edition on RN. I'm Richard Adie, and you're hearing from Anne Wilkes Tucker, Curator of Photography at the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, Texas.
She's the driving force behind a remarkable exhibition and book, War Photography, Images of Armed Conflict and Its Aftermath. And I put it to her that what this collection makes clear is that despite changes in time and place and in technology, that war is always brutal, bloody and terrible.
And the human costs are extraordinary. And that's why we put civilians, have sections on civilians and children as well, because we didn't just want it to be the combatants. They are not the only people affected in situation of armed conflict. But there's also humor and hope and some relief in the exhibition. There is a man who's using his gas mask to peel onions, and there are servicemen letting off steam by wrestling each other or throwing up a comrade in the air. So we tried to show that it's not all horror. We tried to show courage. We tried to show skill, reconnaissance, and other aspects of that are involved in it. We showed the behind the lines support, the people who have to supply the bread and the shoes and the plans. We just tried to not just focus on fighting. It's just one section, but to show all the complexities. There's a section on faith. And so we wanted people to understand the complexity of it. And one of the things that pleased us the most was some veterans organizations in Houston requested an evening when the veterans could bring their families, because some of the veterans apparently found it easier to talk about their experiences through the photographs. And that was, for me, that was wonderful, that if we could make that easier for them, then great.
Actually, that leads me to something I've been really fascinated by since I first looked at the book, and that is, this was a 10-year process for you. How has putting it together affected you? Because it must have affected you.
Well, there were certainly nights when each of us individually, or on some nights altogether, didn't sleep well. We have seen man's capacity for inhumanity to his fellow man in extremes that it's just hard to comprehend. There are two separate pictures in the exhibition of armed people bayoneting unarmed people who are alive at the moment that they are being bayoneted. The section on executions is really hard, and I learned that executions are a standard way of killing people in wartime, and very seldom does it involve a trial that is a real trial with defense and evidence. And I learned a lot. That was the best part for me, is learning new photographers whose work I'd never encountered, histories of conflicts that I never knew about. The power of photography was reaffirmed for me. I am changed by this experience. I am more in awe of the photographers who believe that it is important for these pictures to be made. We lost two of the photographers during the exhibition. Chris Andros and Tim Hetherington were killed in Libya. But the photographers were some of the smartest people I've ever met. They knew the issues. They knew the players. They knew the risk. They were smart about evaluating those risks and when to get out. Sometimes it didn't work out. So there was just an expanse of knowledge that was previously not within my realm of experience.
And what has been... Actually, I'll ask you another question before I do that. There's a comment in the catalogue from Pulitzer Prize winner David Leeson, who said he was searching for but never found a series of photos or a single one that could end war. And I'll just quote. He says, "I still really believe there's a photograph worth dying for, but can you find it? I never did." It's a remarkable thing to say, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I was stunned when I first read it. Sure, photographers would. They'd love to make that picture. I'm not sure so many of them believe that that's possible. I came away from this believing that war is within us as human beings and that it will never go away. And I came away believing that wars don't end, that our father's wars are our wars and our wars are our children's wars. And the seeds of that lead to further wars. But there is greed and ambition and coveting and all those other things that bring us into conflict with each other. And I just don't see it ending. And part of the power of the exhibition, we had a wall at the, what started as one wall at the end of the exhibition where anybody could write anything on a 3x5 card. It eventually expanded to 3 walls. So many people chose to write something. And they were heartbroken, I think, is one of the consensus of comments that, what we're capable of doing, but also when you see it across time, when you see the same thing happening again and again and again and again across country, across time, across faith, it is sobering and saddening.
That was the curator of photography at the Museum of Fine Arts in Austin, Texas, in the United States. She's also the author of a book entitled War Photography, The Images of Armed Conflict and Its Aftermath. It's published by Yale University Press. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file. The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
Hi, my name's Colin Newell, and I'm the editor and creator of DXR.ca. Since the mid-90s, DXR.ca has been the go-to website for timely resources for the DXR, SWL, and broadcast listener. If you're looking for unbiased reviews of the most modern receivers and antennas, or are interested in participating in some of the more lively online forums all about radio, then come on by. DXR.ca, a world band radio website.
All right, it's now time in the program to turn our attention to propagation, what's been happening, and what we can expect. Here's our propagation editor and host of World of Radio, heard on many stations worldwide, with this week's propagation.
Keith from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through February 18th, normal to fair. From Space Weather South Africa through February 18th, magnetic conditions unsettled to quiet, shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK through February 19th, solar activity very low. From FK Yanda in Prague, the geomagnetic field will be quiet to active on February 17th, 20th, 22nd, 25th, 27th, March 3rd to 6th. Active to disturbed on February 18th, 28th, March 1st and 2nd. Mostly quiet on February 19th and March 7th. Quiet on February 21st, 23rd, 24th, 26th, March 8th and 9th. From SWPC in Boulder, ANKNC is peaking at 15 and 4 February 23rd, 30 and 6 on February 28th, with G2 moderate geomagnetic storm levels. Lowest A's and K's of 5 and 2 on February 19th to 21st, 26th, and March 7th to 11th. Solar flux peaking at 85 on February 21st, down to 72 on March 5th to 7th. William Hepburn's VHF UHF DX maps show extreme tropospheric ducting into the Gulf of Mexico from Houston around 0600 UT February 19th, off southern Brazil to Uruguay February 18th to 21st, around Cabo Verde off West Africa February 17th to 21st, between Oman and India February 17th to 20th, along the east coast of India February 21st, and along the northwest coast of Australia February 19th to 21st.
Thanks a lot, Glenn. And with that, we've come to the end of another edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International, heard on the World Radio Network and fine partner stations everywhere. Our email, of course, is mnp@pcjmedia.com. So, on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. 73 and 88 to the ladies.